Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, and welcome to Native on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Brianna Kurtz. Each week, this show features a U.S. or international location and uses food and drink as a gateway to explore and celebrate the cuisine and culture of a destination. Part travel show, part current affairs, Native recognizes the fact that food culture is everywhere and takes the opportunity to examine the nuances that help define a place by using the eyes, ears, and taste buds of farmers, chefs, journalists, and the like. This week, I am joined by Judy Hobart, food and prop stylist for Savor Magazine, to discuss Iceland, which is featured in their most recent edition, in stores and on newsstands now. So hello, Judy. Welcome to Heritage Radio. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Brianna. This is so great to be here.
So your article in this edition of Savor is very personal in a lot of ways. So I'm just wondering, why Iceland?
I just had an interest in seeing the country. It was just at the top of my destination. I don't know exactly. I felt very strongly about seeing it and visiting Iceland.
And how many times have you personally visited?
So far, twice. I was there in late 2013 for the story itself. And I went back in May of 2014 on an unrelated trip.
And I think the country has a really interesting landscape of these extremes of darkness and lightness and harsh, you know, cold. And so what is that? But it also has volcanoes. So it has this heat, you know,
right,
coming up from the earth. And so how does that all play out into the landscape of agriculture and cuisine?
Well, you know, that part of the year there's sunlight almost nonstop. The rest of the year it's really dark. When I was there last December, we had about 4 hours of daylight, and it never got very bright. It was sort of dawn into dusk the whole time. I think because of the landscape, because of the volcanic geothermal activity, a lot of the and the proximity to the Arctic Circle, there isn't a whole lot available of available land for agriculture. So basically, Icelanders across the centuries, they do have some agriculture, and especially recently, their greenhouses to supply them with a lot of their fresh produce. But really, they've relied on fishing, on animal husbandry, and on the limited agriculture that they're able to provide with the growing season.
And probably a lot of preservation techniques. So you're seeing
definitely
fermentation and smoking
and
curing air dry, and freezing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
How does that, what are some examples of that you see in the products of Iceland?
Well, there was a lot of smoked meat when I was there and air dried fish. Smoked lamb is probably one of the most traditional things served on Christmas, for Christmas Eve dinner or for Christmas Day dinner. And that was, I mean, it's smoked usually in very traditional ways, usually using sheep dung that's been dried and compressed, which gives it a really interesting flavor. It's almost like the terroir of Iceland sort of goes into the food. They have something called hardfiskur, which is air-dried fish. They hang the fish in drying sheds, and it's just wind. Wind dries the fish, and it basically, they take it, they beat it with a mallet to soften it up, and then they spread it with butter. They haven't really been able to grow bread or grains for bread, you know, across the centuries. So for a very long time, that was a bread substitute for them.
Oh, wow. Interesting. And that's something you see all year long or just at the holiday time?
No, all year long. And when I tried it, I was a little bit, I can't eat bread myself. I have a gluten intolerance. So when I was there, it was actually great for me and it was really delicious. I actually brought a lot back with me and I still snack on it.
You may be onto something for a great gluten-free export for
very high protein, very low carbs. It's really healthy.
Well, I was really wondering, how does Icelandic cuisine fit into the larger category of Nordic cuisine and how does it distinguish itself from that trend?
Well, I think that Iceland, the chefs there have sort of signed on with the New Nordic Cuisine movement, which is about sustainability, locality, foraging. And I actually got to meet Chef Gunnar Karlgíslason when I was there. He's the chef owner of Dill Restaurant, and he's at the forefront of the movement in Iceland. A lot of Icelandic chefs do what a lot of chefs here in the U.S. do. They you know, go to Europe. They go to some of the larger cities, and that happened to be, in a lot of times, Denmark, because Denmark and Iceland, traditionally, they have a long history together. Denmark pretty much owned Iceland up until, you know, about a century ago. Yep. So I think that a lot of the chefs brought back those sort of principles with them to Iceland. And what sets the Icelandic cuisine apart is they're using all of these Icelandic products, and they're also getting back to using the traditional sources, the traditional methods. Gunnar is sourcing things from local chefs, from local or from local farmers, from local purveyors. He's foraging himself, and I think that started a wider movement within Iceland to use Icelandic products. So, therefore, it's going to have that very unique Icelandic quality of the food, very, very Icelandic ingredients that you can't get everywhere.
In addition to the foraging and kind of local sense, are there other trends right now that you're seeing in Iceland as far as the food goes?
The chefs are taking a lot of the traditional foods of Iceland, the smoked lamb, the fermented meats, the grains are coming back, barley and oats, which for a long time they weren't able to grow on the island because over the centuries, the climate has changed quite a lot. They go through cold spells where grain just won't grow. Mm. They're kind of going into a warmer climate now. Farmers are reforesting the island just so they can have more oxygen, they can have more warmth to grow their grains. They're taking old cuisine and they're modernizing it.
And as far as, let's jump into some of the seafood dishes, because obviously it's an island.
Right.
Both the industry and how seafood manifests on the table. So you talked about the dried fish with the butter.
Right.
But how about the state of the industry? Is it going through kind of a renaissance with food becoming more and more of an important thing into the local culture?
I think that for a long time, Icelanders, they really weren't, it sounds strange to say they're an island nation, but they weren't eating a lot of fish. They were eating haddock, which is the air-dried fish is usually haddock. Things like langoustines, shellfish, they weren't really using those. That wasn't a part of their native diet. A lot of the fish was exported. Their industry was based on an export basis. They were exporting to Europe, especially countries like Spain and Portugal who wanted salt cod. Only within the last century have Icelanders started eating more fish and fresher fish. Before, it was air-dried or it was boiled or it was breaded and fried. And that's one of the things that chefs are doing now is they're kind of bringing new and updated fish dishes to the modern Icelander.
And what about seaweed? Did you have any dishes with seaweed while you were there?
I did. I actually got to eat at Dill. It was used as a garnish, a condiment. It powdered, oil. And traditionally, it was also used in soups. And because they didn't have a lot of grain, what grain they did have, which was usually imported from Denmark or Norway, sometimes they kind of cut the grain or the flour with seaweed.
It sounds very similar in a lot of ways to almost a Japanese culture in the sense around the fish and also that all of the bounty of the ocean kind of coming onto the table.
Yeah. I actually got to visit a fish processing plant when I was there last December, and it was amazing just to see the boats come in. Everything was processed immediately. Then it was shipped out. Sometimes, the fish was, it was 10 hours from the time that it left the boats until it was on its way over to Europe.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your article in the magazine this month. You, one of your hosts, Nana, has a cookbook, Icelandic Food and Cookery, and she seems like such a matriarchal character. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about your time with her.
Right.
And kind of, I want to know a little bit more about the role of women in the preparation of the food in Iceland.
Okay. When I knew that I was heading to Iceland to do the story, I started researching immediately because I honestly needed to know, and I didn't have a really good basis for what was the food like at that point. I just had a very general idea. And the one book I found in English was Nana's cookbook. And I started reading it, and it was really fascinating because she does have recipes, of course, but she gives so much history and so much personal narrative in her cookbook. It's really, it fascinated me, and it made me even more excited to visit. It made me even more excited about the food. I think that people have maybe the impression that Iceland is cold, it's dark, and that the food must reflect that somehow. Mm-hmm. But I really found anything but. I found that there was so much lightness with the people, with their attitude, as well as with the food. It wasn't heavy. You know, there were some very hearty dishes, but there was a lightness to the food as well.
And do you see in the family sense that more women are in the kitchen than, or is it a family event where everyone kind of chips in and contributes?
When I was there, I saw it as a family affair. Nana did a lot of the cooking, but her grandson Ulfur was there, and he was helping out so much. And then when I visited my friends Kjartan and Kaja, they hosted a Thorlax Mesa, which is a St. Thorlax
skate
party.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. Yeah.
You know, it was really... Kjartan was really the one in the kitchen. He was, you know, kind of whirling around, making all this food for all the guests, and it was amazing to see. So I don't know. I think in past times, it was the job of the women to be in the kitchen to provide, you know, the sustenance for the family. But these days, I think Iceland's very modern, and it's a shared responsibility.
Well, let's talk about that celebration of St. Thorax. So this, based on your article, this appears to be the largest food celebration. It's December 23rd?
Christmas, I feel like, is the largest. And Christmas starts on... Christmas is 13 days long, mm-hmm. The celebration, and it starts on Christmas Eve. So St. Thorax, he's the patron saint of Iceland. And basically, he died on that day in the 11th century. So that's why it's his day. So... there's a tradition of eating rotten skate on the 23rd, and it's just like it sounds. It's rotten. It's fermented skate, and it's usually boiled, and it's then served with melted sheep's fat. So I tried it. I can't say that I'm a personal fan. A lot of Icelanders love it. A lot of them don't like it, but it's a tradition. And from what I understand, the way it started was there's this amazing Christmas bounty for 13 days starting on the Christmas Eve, and Icelanders look forward to this all year long. So what better way to enjoy this bounty of goodness than by eating something a little bit rotten the day before? It's this strange, weird logic, but it kind of makes sense to me.
Interesting. And there was another item in the article, the leaf bread, and how ubiquitous that is. And
right.
Does it vary from family to family, or is there kind of one traditional kind of that it's used, way that it's prepared?
I think that it is pretty traditional throughout. I mean, I think that every family probably has maybe a slightly different recipe, but it's an older tradition, and it's a fried bread because for a long time, the average Icelander didn't have an oven. So it was the one time of the year when the whole family would come into the kitchen to prepare this bread. Usually, you know, a few days before Christmas, it was to be eaten on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, a lot of times with smoked lamb. And it was kind of a family affair to make this bread, decorate this bread. It's intricately cut out so that when it's fried, it has these beautiful patterns, very unique. No single leaf bread is alike. They're a little bit like snowflakes. So in that regard.
They are quite beautiful in the photographs in the article. And I love the roller.
Yeah.
Because it seems so like an artisanal utensil that's been crafted specifically for this purpose.
Yes.
I was wondering if there were, if you could talk a little bit about that, maybe different variations that you saw, or are there other utensils similar in nature to things that you've only seen in Iceland?
That's the only sort of tool that when I was over there, that was Nana's tool that we, you know, we used in her kitchen. I did see a couple more in shops in Reykjavik. I believe, I could be wrong, but as far as I understand it, there's maybe one or two people in all of Iceland that make that. And it's for the very specific purpose of making leaf bread. it's hard to get a hold of the tool, especially over here. I wasn't able to source one over here, but you can use a paring knife and get the same effect. It's not quite as easy or as fun, but yeah.
That would see, just based on the intricate kind of like lattice, like yeah. patterns that with a paring knife, that might take some real skill and practice.
it does a little bit. It looks more difficult than it actually is. Mm-hmm. And we actually have a step-by-step tutorial that's online on Sevur.com.
Excellent. I want to talk really quick before we go on a commercial break about Yolakaturin,
the Christmas cat.
Yes. Tell me about this cat.
So there are some kind of dark Christmas legends in Iceland, and that revolves around the 13 Christmas lads who, there's one lad per day of Christmas, 13 celebration days, and they're kind of mischievous imps. They do things like put rotten potatoes in shoes and steal porridge and things like that. And the cat belongs to their mother. And as far as, like, this is what I understand of the legend. Everyone needs to get a new piece of clothing on Christmas Eve and then wear it. Otherwise, the cat may eat you.
Okay. Have you ever read The Master and Margarita?
No.
By Bulgakov. There's just like this hilarious, pretty twisted evil cat. And I laughed out loud when I was reading your article because I just imagined the cat from The Master Margarita. So I really got a kick out of it. But very interesting. So it's kind of like motivating the kids to get on the good list.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll be learning more about Iceland with Judy Hobart.
Listening to I'm Famous by Alan Wilkes.
The following program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
It is so exciting to have this new medium.
Hosting After the Jump has been a huge part of me transitioning from being a blogger to somebody who has sort of real important conversations with people in real life.
My show, I kind of describe it as an audio trade magazine.
I learn a ton from the guests every week, whether it's restaurants, bars.
All the hosts at Heritage all come from different perspectives.
Everyone should be listening to this. If you're interested in conservation and practical approach to renewable food sources, you know, not this big industry.
Whether it's history, laws, social policies of food, I think people now take food seriously, and hopefully what's on their plate will become something very special.
And I feel that podcasting has a future, giving people information in a format they can really use on the go.
We need your support to keep these conversations going. To donate, visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
All right, we are back. I am Brianna Kurtz, and you are listening to Native on Heritage Radio. And today I'm talking to Judy Hobart of Sevur Magazine, all about Icelandic culture and cuisine. So I want to take a step back from food for just a moment and talk a little bit more about the the landscape of mm-hmm. what's going on in Iceland right now. In 2008, there was, you know, the worldwide recession, and all of Iceland's major banks collapsed. Their currency, the krona, imploded, which, you know, kind of set off a series of reforms and investigations as it does, and luckily now moving kind of more into recovery. So, but despite all of that, Iceland is really seemed to stay on the top of, like, as far as a tourist destination, and it seems like they've put a lot of work into promoting the island as such. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience of, are people still talking about the economics of what's going on, and did the collapse actually help in a way?
I think it's very present still for mm-hmm. a lot of Icelanders. Reading up on everything, Icelanders are now helping to pay off their national debt. Every person is sort of responsible for that. And I think that up to the point of the collapse, Iceland was really, it seemed like maybe they were focused outwards. They were getting a lot of imports from all around the globe. They had this time of amazing prosperity. But I think that the collapse sort of let them focus again inwards on what was happening closer to home. And in a strange way, it seems like the Nordic food movement that sort of came to Iceland around the same time almost got a boost in a strange way from the collapse, because all of a sudden sustainable, local, getting things from the island itself rather than from around the world started becoming way more important from an economic angle. So in a really backwards way, I think that it did focus both chefs and consumers on, you know, all the wonderful bounty that Iceland has to offer.
And you did kind of talk about that inward kind of almost introspection of the chefs, especially mm-hmm. with Gunnar in the first half of the show saying, you know, foraging,
right.
local, exporting fish and all of those things. So hopefully there's a silver lining
yeah.
to all of that. And who knows how they will continue to kind of evolve out of that.
Right. And I think that so many more, just even within the past year, I've heard so much more about Iceland as a travel destination, as a culinary destination. I think maybe it's been on my radar a little bit more, but I can't deny that so many people have reached out to me, friends of friends, and said, hey, I heard you were in Iceland. I really can't wait to go. What can you tell me about going there? What can you tell me about Reykjavik? What can you tell me about eating there, about traveling destinations, what to do? And so it's just been so amazing to see Iceland just kind of blooming out of this major, economic collapse that was so devastating. And something new is coming out of it that the people there, I think that it's such a small island. There are 350,000 people or a little bit less on the entire island. And so it's very tight knit. It's really a sense of community within a country. It was not uncommon, even in the 10 days that I was originally there, to, you know, run into somebody on the street that I had met just days before at a friend's party, or I would say, I would mention someone by name, and the person I was talking to is like, oh, yeah, Siggy, of course.
So Siggy's a really popular name. There must be a few of them.
There are. Gunnar is a popular name. Siggy's a popular name, yeah.
I just had another quick question about the dining scene. The Dill is a now worldwide,
yes.
world-known restaurant. And is there a balance between formal and informal as far as the food scene goes? Is it skewing one way or the other?
I think that I ate at Dill when I was there, and they've since opened up a few other, restaurants. Kex Hostel has a small eatery. Dill has its own pizza shop now. So I feel like even at Dill itself, it was very approachable. It was very casual in a sense and comfortable. The food was elevated, but yet there was no pretension about it.
Almost a comfort.
Yeah, it was elevated comfort food.
And what about, I want to talk about some of the dishes featured in the magazine this month. The langoustine soup, which you alluded to in the first half.
Right.
I thought it was really interesting that there was curry in this dish. Can
yes.
you tell me a little bit about how that came to be?
just through my research, back, I believe, in the 15th century, British fishermen and merchants started coming to Iceland to trade, especially, you know, because of the fishing industry there. And they brought a handful of spices with them. Up until recently, an Icelander's spice cabinet might have included just a handful of things besides salt and pepper. It might have included allspice, clove, cardamom, bay leaf, and curry powder. So As I had also been saying, langoustines, shellfish, weren't really eaten very commonly in Icelandic households until the past few decades. And I think that was an American and European innovation with, you know, a lobster bisque or something along those lines. So Icelanders sort of adopted that and made it their own, and they added curry powder. And that is really one of my favorite recipes. It is so delicious and so warming and so rich, and yet strangely not heavy. I really, really love the recipe.
Excellent. And we have to talk about skyr.
Yes.
So it is ubiquitous, but if you could maybe explain a little bit about what that is and how many different ways you saw it used throughout mealtime.
Sure. Well, it seems, I think the most common reference would be something like Greek yogurt. It's very like Greek yogurt, but it's actually a fresh cheese. It's cultured the same way that fresh cheeses are cultured, and it's low in fat, it's high in protein. Icelanders have been using it for centuries because it provided the most yield from their milk, and they needed to make sure they had enough food to last through times of famine, harsh winters. So, and one of the byproducts of skyr is whey, and whey is a preservative that has been used in Iceland for a long time. So when I was there, I mean, it's usually eaten for breakfast or for dessert, the same way we would use Greek yogurt here with berries or, you know, muesli, or in a panna cotta or something for a dessert, which is what they're doing now with it. But, you know, it's also being used as a sauce. It's being used as, you know, in savory preparations as like a thickener or a creamy addition to soups. I would say that there are some skyr drinks, and whey also is, I don't know how popular it is still, but it's highly nutritious, and whey has been drunk in Iceland for a really long time. And I was actually in Whole Foods maybe like a week ago, and I saw whey, just a jar of whey to drink. It's interesting.
Well, as with all holidays in any culture, the sweets are very important.
Yes.
So what can you tell me about some of the desserts or sweet dishes that accompanied holiday meals in Iceland?
When I was at Nana's for Thorlaxmesa, she had this buffet table of so many desserts. It was overwhelming. Some of the things that we featured in the magazine, there was Wiener Tarte, which is, it's Vienna torte, comes from the European tradition of, you know, these layered torts, and it's basically a shortbread slightly flavored with cardamom and then layered with homemade prune filling, and then it gets a light coffee glaze. It's beautiful. And there were so many different kinds of cookies as well. Meringues are really popular. There are a couple meringue cookies that I had when I was over there. One is like a cornflake chocolate meringue. It's just, you know, beaten egg whites, sugar, dark chocolate, and cornflakes. I think that my favorite cookie of all time, maybe of all time, like not just Iceland, but it's called a Sarah Bernhardt cookie, named after the French actress. She visited Copenhagen at the height of her career, and the cookie somehow was named after her, made its way to Iceland. It's an almond meringue with chocolate buttercream and then dipped in dark chocolate, and it just melts in your mouth. And we actually have a recipe for it on Savour.com. It's delicious.
Wow, I'm just like imagining that, like dipping in the chocolate with the...
It's so decadent. It's so delicious.
Wow. And well, non-traditional. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the scape.
Yes.
Were there other things that you ate that were kind of non-traditional and very inherent to Iceland? Like, I know I've heard reindeer.
Yeah.
I've heard puffin.
Yeah.
I've heard whale.
I ate all those things.
Okay.
I had reindeer three ways. I had seared reindeer, I had a reindeer tureen, and I had like reindeer carpaccio, raw reindeer. That was, they were all delicious. It was a little bit gamey, a little bit like venison. Mm-hmm. I had raw mink whale. It was actually more like beef tartare than it was, I mean, somewhere between tuna tartare and beef tartare. I did eat puffin. They're so cute, but they're also delicious. It was a little bit gamey, a little bit fishy. It was smoked. It had a smoky flavor to it. I ate smoked foal's tongues. That came from the farm that Nana grew up on. Her cousin sent them down for her Christmas buffet. I had smoked raw leg of lamb. It was smoked so many times that it was this like dark mahogany color. It was so rich. It was so smoky. What else did I eat? I ate a hakarl, which is fermented shark. It burned going down. It's a very...
In a bitter, sharp kind of way, or...?
In an acrid ammonia sort of way. Okay. It, like, yeah. my throat and my tongue actually went numb a little bit. And then I did eat the skate, a skata, the rotten skate. It was, like I said before, it wasn't to my taste. It was interesting. I'm very glad I tried it.
It sounds like a great destination for anyone who's really interested in trying some kind of...
Definitely.
Really adventurous.
Yeah, there was some adventurous eating.
Excellent. Well, what about, we mentioned just the skier drink, but what about drinking? Like, what do you, are there homecrafted beers, spirits?
I think the most ubiquitous Icelandic drink is Brennevin. It's a schnapps. It's flavored lightly with caraway. So it has a little bit of a rye flavor. And usually it's served cold. Usually it's served in shots. And it's really, really great for washing down either fermented shark or skate. It really helps. It helps in more ways than one. Their beer tradition is fairly new. They weren't allowed to brew beer until the late 80s. There was just a strange prohibition on beer. But now there are these microbreweries springing up. And one of the very classic Christmas time drinks is something called Appleson and Malt. It's orange soda mixed with a very low alcohol malted barley ale. It's interesting. But everyone drank it. You know, I think it's kind of one of those things that because of the low alcohol, you know, it's all age groups are kind of
able to enjoy it. Is it like a little bit like an aperitif with the orange soda?
It's almost like a punch.
Okay.
It's almost like a Christmas punch. And there are some really interesting new spirits that are being made in Iceland right now using traditional ingredients like birch. Mm-hmm. Birch to flavor liqueur and liquors and schnapps. Foss Brewery has teamed up with Gunnar Carl Gieses and Chef of Dill, and they've been making a couple birch-infused spirits that you can now get in the States, and they're actually really delicious, a little bit smoky, a little bit sweet. They have a really earthy quality to them. They're called Birkir and Bjork.
Excellent. Well, hopefully listeners will seek those out to try them for yourselves. What about you? Any plans to go back soon?
Actually, I do have a plan to go back, hopefully early in 2015. My roommate was there a few years ago, and I really want to go back. We're planning on taking a Northern Lights tour and also visiting friends in Reykjavik.
Well, it'll be nice. I mean, you were there during the holiday, so it'll be a couple months later. So
yeah.
It's always interesting to visit places in different times of the year and see what experiences that offers you.
Yes, I was there, during the time of the winter solstice last year, and we had 4 hours of daylight, and I was there again, you know, in the summertime, and it was the opposite. We only had, you know, 4 hours of darkness, and I loved both times, but I have to say that something about that dark wintry, you know, Icelandic landscape draws me to it more so than the, you know, 20 hours of daylight. Mm. I really like that comforting, warm feeling of being there in the winter, and the people are so warm and the food is so comforting. It's really nice.
Wonderful. Well, Judy, thank you so much for joining me today. We are about out of time, but you can pick up Savora's latest edition now and try some of the dishes we talked about today for yourself for this holiday season. Thank you.
Thanks. This has been so much fun.
Be sure to join me next week when I'll be talking to Aldo Sam of Le Bernardin in Sambar about his native Austria and some great wines to pair with your big holiday meals. As always, right here on Heritage Radio every Thursday morning at 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.